even after Carney's speech, nominally separating Canada from the U.S., our news media still largely covers atrocities committed with wishy-washy bullshit language. If you, like me, saw footage of Alex Pretti's execution, you probably feel similar. It destroys you inside. He and Rene Goode are not the only people who have been killed by ICE. They also won't be the last. It's debilitating. But people are still coming out into the streets. People are standing with their community. If they can do that in Minneapolis, we can do it too. So even though we have officially entered the years, that doesn't mean we should give up. Thank you for listening to The North State. If you'd like to support the show, you can go to readthecatch.ca and sign up for a free or paid membership. You can share this with your friends, rate us 5 stars on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Follow me on Blue Sky at ucotscott.com. I'll talk to you soon.
That was a recent episode of The North State. Find new episodes at host Scott Martin's thecatch.ca Substack and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Since launching in October 2022, Sources provided in-depth interviews with experts and newsmakers across the country from the award-winning journalists at Press Progress. On this excerpt from a new episode, Eric Wickham sits down with Palestinian students and scholars at Risk Network's Nada El-Falou to hear how Canada's inactions endangering students who've already been accepted into grad programs across the country. Now, here's Eric.
This is Sources. I'm your host, Ontario reporter Eric Wickham. Sources is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Over 100 students are stuck in limbo as they wait for the Canadian government to approve their student visas. These students all have one thing in common. They live in or are from Gaza. Palestinian students and scholars at risk has been sounding the alarm about these visas being held up, which, according to them, is putting the lives of these students at risk. Student visas require specific biometric data. And for those students stuck in Gaza, there's nowhere for them to get that biometric information processed. Also, unlike the UK, Germany, Italy, or Ireland, Canada has failed to allow exemptions or help the students evacuate. According to advocates, some students have now been waiting for 16 months for their Canadian visas to be approved. Joining me on Sources today is Nada El-Falou, Director of Student Services at Palestinian Students and Scholars at Risk, or PSSAR. Nada, welcome to Sources.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To begin this conversation, why are graduate students accepted to Canadian universities currently stuck in Gaza?
Unfortunately, this is because of the delays they're facing in the study permit processes, which is the way that they apply for visas to come to Canada. These students have applied for study permits over a year ago, a lot of them up to 18 months ago, and they're still waiting for their applications to be processed.
And so how many students are we currently talking about?
We're talking about 130, more than 130, who have submitted their study permit applications. And for the record, not all of them are in Gaza. Some of them, about 30 of them, are in Egypt.
In the PSSAR press conference late last month, it was said that the Canadian government was asking for specific biometric data to get these visas approved, but there are no offices or structures in Gaza that are able to provide these biometrics. Mm-hmm. So what biometrics are needed specifically to process these visas?
This is a requirement required by IRCC, Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship Canada, IRCC. They require all applicants to submit their biometrics, which are fingerprints and photographs, at designated centers. Now, Gaza never had a center. As far as I know, Gaza never had a center in the past. And what people used to do was cross over to Egypt, to Cairo, where there is a center, or sometimes to Jordan as well. However, since early 2024, the border, the Rafah border between Gaza and Egypt, has been completely shut down. And so these students have not been able to leave Gaza to provide their biometrics.
Why have there not been exemptions from this, given the obvious extenuating circumstances future students are facing in Gaza right now?
I believe this is just a lack of political will. there should be exemptions, and there have been exemptions in the past. However, it is very clear to me that IRCC chooses not to make the process easier for residents. They are not exempting the biometrics requirement, even though it is impossible for them to provide their biometrics. And they're also not facilitating exits for residents, unlike other countries. The UK, Ireland, they have facilitated safe exit for residents who have secured scholarships and so on in their countries. They help them with the overall process. Some of them also have biometrics requirements, but they facilitated the process to help these students because it's not at their fault that they can't provide them.
On top of that, despite the IRCC's position that these biometrics are necessary to process these visas, some students have the necessary biometrics and are still not getting their visas approved, which to me seems to poke holes in the idea that the Canadian government is just trying their best to follow their own process. Have they given any other reasons to not approve these specific visas?
They have not. So there are a few people in Gaza who had provided their biometrics a long time ago. You know, biometrics are valid for up to 10 years. And so there are a few in Gaza who had provided their biometrics in the past. There are students in Egypt, some of our students, as I said, about 30 of them in Egypt, who have been able to provide their biometrics. And yet they're also facing the delays of up to 18 months, at least so far and counting, right? So unfortunately, I don't think the biometrics requirement is the obstacle. I think it's the easiest obstacle to point fingers at. However, as I said, there are students who provided their biometrics, some in, some outside of Gaza, and they're facing the exact same delays. When we've asked IRCC why this is the case, they kind of did not give a straight answer. And a lot of times they kept saying, you know, these applications must be non-routine and, you know, let me take a look at the application. But from where I stand, it cannot be a coincidence. It is statistically almost impossible to me that this is a coincidence of all of these applications being non-routine. Other applications submitted in the same office in Egypt are being processed between, you know, 6 to 9, maybe 12 weeks, while Palestinian applications are taking over a year and a half. That's not non-routine. That's something systematic, a systematic bias against Palestinian students.
Has this ever happened in the past that the IRCC seems to have slowed down for a specific group of people like this?
I don't think I know the answer to that as just, you know, as a part of PSSAR, I'm not a politician, I'm not an immigration expert, so I don't really have an answer to that. But as far as I know, not really. And especially about Palestinians, Canada has had a history of upholding their commitment to global academic solidarity and allowing Palestinian students to study in Canada in the past. It doesn't make sense that it stopped now.
Is it fair to characterize the Canadian government's inaction on this as putting these academics in danger?
Yes, very much so. As I said, these delays have been happening for over a year and a half. Our students in this year and a half have been facing airstrikes. They have been facing hunger. They have been facing displacement. Almost all of them at least have lived in tents, if not are still living in tents today. We know how the weather is right now in Gaza. There are storms and rains. People are dying of hunger and of severe cold. And that's all excluding the fact that there were still airstrikes in the last year and a half. And right now they're still at risk. You know, I'm not a political expert, but I don't think it's safe to say that they're safe yet. On top of that, even if it was physically safe, universities have been destroyed. All 12 universities in Gaza have been destroyed. Their mosques have been destroyed. Their community centers. I mentioned mosques because in Gaza, they act as community centers. Their hospitals. And so the infrastructure in Gaza has been destroyed, which is why it is very important for the academics of Gaza to work on rebuilding it. And that's why PSSAR wants to help them.
I was reading into a little bit of the history of students in Gaza getting accepted to universities. And one of the stories that stuck out to me was back in December 2024, Sally and Dahlia Ghazi Abaid were killed in bombings in Gaza. After being accepted into the PhD programs at the University of Waterloo, they were accepted through the Global Student Relief Initiative. Has something happened to the GSRI since then?
That's an interesting question. As far as I've seen, the University of Waterloo has taken down the page, especially the Global Relief Fellowship, I believe it's called, that they created for Palestinians. They did remove the page. However, I do know from our PSSAR students that they still do have their admissions. I just don't think that they opened a new cycle for students. But honestly, I do care about the institutional support for Palestinian students. However, it's not our bottleneck right now. We've definitely faced, you know, different reactions from institutions. Some of them have been way more supportive than others. Some of them have been kind of, you know, here and there. But right now, I think that we have students who already have admissions, and I want these students to start their studies before it's too late.
Right. I mean, and the bottleneck right here is the Government of Canada and the IRCC.
Correct.
On September 16th of last year, the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory released a report saying Israel has committed genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. This commission urged all states to fulfill their legal obligations under international law to end the genocide and to hold the perpetrators of this genocide accountable. And as we know, this has not happened. Putting this issue in the context of Canada's inaction towards the genuine atrocities that are happening in Gaza, how should Canadians interpret the federal government's seeming lack of interest in solving this visa issue for students who are still stuck there?
It is a significant concern. If Canada does not support this, what will Canada support? That's my question as a Canadian citizen myself. And so talking about the genocide in Gaza with the inaction with the students, you know, we also had a meeting with IRCC, the academics, the professors had a meeting with IRCC, raising this issue to them, telling them that they're very concerned about their students. And IRCC's response was that this is not a priority for them, point blank. And so I find that very concerning, again, as a citizen and as an academic myself. There are so many layers to this. There is the humanitarian layer, which I think is very obvious, and we spoke about. The universities have been destroyed. These students are at risk. As you mentioned, we already lost two students after they received their admissions from the University of Waterloo. And of course, there's the academic side, both for Gazans and for Canadians. I know as an academic that we value the international academic community. We value sharing our knowledge. We value having international students and having our students study abroad as well. What does this say about us? That this is not a priority. These Palestinian students are not a priority, neither because they're students nor because they're Palestinian. There are multiple layers to this that make this a very, very important issue. And I don't see how IRCC could say that.
Yeah, it's kind of a shocking thing to hear. Are there potential avenues forward to get these students' visas approved? If so, what's needed to make this happen?
I believe the demands here are for IRCC and the Canadian government in general. You know, it's a government's responsibility to stop this bureaucratic finger pointing within the government. You know, they keep referring us to different groups in the government. Sorry, I'm not a political person, so maybe I'm not using the correct terminology, but just bureaucratic finger pointing to different people in the government, to the biometrics issue, lack of transparency, you know, when we ask them what the issues are, or we don't have the resources. So this is ultimately the government's responsibility. We need the government to process these visas, to coordinate safe passage for those in Gaza, and to uphold Canada's ethical and global commitments. Now, for the people, my fellow Canadians, I urge everyone to mobilize with us. We do have a petition to sign. We have assistance to, you know, please just call your MP, send them an email, and urge them to ask the Prime Minister's office to raise this issue once again, and especially to my fellow academics, because this is our responsibility as Canadians to uphold global academic solidarity and to mobilize for our fellow academics in Palestine.
Nada, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nada El-Falou, Director of Student Services for Palestinian Students and Scholars at Risk. After this interview, I reached out for comments from IRCC. A spokesperson responded that the government remains deeply concerned about the ongoing situation in Gaza and is committed to a fair and non-discriminatory application of immigration procedures. They added that they understood that some students were experiencing longer processing times for study permits, but prospective international students must still meet all visa requirements, including biometrics and a security screening by a third party. In regards to there not being anywhere for biometrics to be collected, the spokesperson said IRCC understands that this can be challenging for residents of Gaza, but these requirements are necessary to ensure the integrity of our immigration system and the safety of Canadians. Press Progress Sources is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or the podcatcher of your choice, and follow us on social media. We're on Blue Sky at pressprogress.ca and on TikTok at pressprogress.ca. We are currently raising money for a legal defense. Head to journalismdefense.ca to find out how you can help. I was your host, Eric Wickham. Follow me on social media. I'm on Blue Sky at ericwickham.ca and Instagram at ericwickham.journalism. Thanks for listening.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of Press Progress Sources. Find out more at pressprogress.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, since launching in May 2023, Perspectives, the Broadbent Institute's Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy, has brought left-wing thought and inquiry into public debates and policy for building a more just and equitable Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, host Clem Nokos welcomes Patriotic Millionaires Canada's Dylan Dussault for a conversation exploring why we need to tackle extreme wealth inequality to save democracy. Now, here's Clem.
Welcome to Perspectives, a Canadian Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy. I'm Clement Nokos, editor of Perspectives Journal and director of policy and engagement at the Broadbent Institute. What you just heard were two present and contrasting visions for Canadian equality. The first clip was from Prime Minister Mark Carney's much-applauded speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, where, underneath the foreign policy pronouncements, while speaking to the billionaires in attendance at the annual affair, where business and governments rub shoulders, he highlighted tax cuts, AI, mining, and the fossil fuel industry as his key domestic policies. He also just heard from Avi Lewis, currently a candidate running for leadership of the federal New Democratic Party, who took to Bay Street to ask random folks working in Canada's financial center what they thought about his policy commitment of implementing a wealth tax on the richest 1%. According to the Parliamentary Budget Officer, in 2025, a 1% wealth tax on the richest families would take in well over $22 billion annually. Meanwhile, the Carney government's cuts to public services announced as he first took office would total $21.5 billion. These are two competing visions for Canada's economy, and as consistent polling research shows, 90% of Canadians support a wealth tax. To be a part of the top 1% in Canada, the average income for an individual is about $300,000 annually, and the top 1% wealth threshold is about $7 million per family. It's pretty clear what the 99% think about a wealth tax, but what do the richest think? The group Patriotic Millionaires just released a survey of millionaires from across G20 member countries, and most millionaires seem to be on the same page as the 99%. According to this survey, 65% of millionaires polled support higher taxes on the very richest to invest in public services and tackle the cost of living crisis. Apparently, even most of the world's richest would be on board with a vision for society that ensured that the rich paid their fair share. So I asked the rich to tell us more about what they think about wealth taxes. Joining me today is Dylan Dussault, Executive Director of Patriotic Millionaires Canada. So first, let me clear the air. The name of your organization, Patriotic Millionaires, sounds kind of a bit funny to me. It's almost right-wing coded in that there's a sort of nationalism attached to being rich. It almost brings to mind for me the billionaires and oligarchs behind the U.S. Trump administration and MAGA and that whole movement. Could you tell us more about your organization and what you're really about?
Sure. So Patriotic Millionaires Canada is, I'll call it an intentionally slightly obnoxious name. really meant to grab the ears and grab attention. Who we are is we organize high net worth Canadians who are really concerned about the destabilizing impacts of wealth inequality on our economies, on our societies, on our democracies, and want to work collectively to address it, specifically through fixing our tax code, which is currently completely failing to tax the extremely wealthy, and continuing to grow wealth inequality at a higher and higher pace.
And so when we think about, you know, the phrase tax the rich, it's been going around now since, you know, I can remember its popularization under the Occupy Wall Street movement. And, you know, we had this notion of the 99% versus the 1%. You know, what do we mean from your perspective? What do we mean when we say tax the rich? And what does that entail about what we need to do?
Sure. So when we say tax the rich, we are talking about a fairly specific group of high net worth people, right? So for our membership, you know, we say you have to have $5 million in assets, right, to kind of fit our criteria for what we consider rich. The reason for that is that is around the point where you start getting a lot of tax advantages that other people don't have. Right, you at that point can start making most of your income, say, from assets, buying and selling capital gains, borrowing against wealth, etc., as opposed to making most of your money from a paycheck. And that is really the fundamental flaw of the tax code we need to address if we're going to get serious about taxing the rich. It's this the way we continue to value assets and say that they are somehow more beneficial, more important, more worthy of a tax cut than working for a living, right? If you make all of your money from buying and selling stocks, you only pay taxes on 50% of the money you make from that. If you make your money by, you know, going into your service industry job every day, you're paying taxes on everything you make. And, you know, buying and selling stocks doesn't really do much of anything to stimulate our economy. It's kind of just helping make people who already own stocks richer and like maybe paying some dividends out to some shareholders. Whereas people who are actually working for a living are kind of like the engines of our economy. And right now our tax code is valuing them much less. There's also, I would say, a second kind of tier of very, very wealthy people at the higher end who have so much money that they're not even like selling their capital gains. They are never creating realization events. They are never paying taxes. They are borrowing against their assets. They are going to banks and getting these very specially crafted personal loans on a floor of the bank you and I will probably never reach. That is, you know, letting them pay 1-3% interest rates and live a very lavish lifestyle while claiming they're never making any income and allowing their wealth to continue to just expand untaxed indefinitely. And that's why we need to have something like a wealth tax or something that effectively taxes that group that doesn't need to like realize their capital gains ever.
And so earlier this episode, before our interview, we aired a clip from Carney's speech at the World Economic Forum, where the world's richest attended and applauded his admission that liberalism was failing and his declaration of a foreign policy reorientation. But, you know, he also made a number of statements on his own domestic economic priorities and policies. How should the wealthy feel about Carney's wealth tax policies?
Yeah, I mean, what I will say is Carney has no plans to tax wealth. In fact, like during that speech, he, you know, waxed poetic about his own tax cuts, how they undid the attempt to reform capital gains tax that was started in the previous administration, or walked it back on the campaign trail, however you want to say it. How, you know, they got rid of carbon taxes, they got rid of the digital services tax, they created more corporate tax breaks in their latest budget. And, you know, he has this belief that this is what is going to, like, draw investments into this country, right? It's going to make it more appealing to foreign investment. It's going to make it more appealing to be, like, an entrepreneur in this country, to start a business, to whatever. You know, I think what the wealthy people involved in our group feel, what I feel, is that's, like, a really fundamental misunderstanding of, like, what draws investment and what encourages entrepreneurship. If we think that our tax rate is going to be what brings investment in this country, we are never going to win a race to the bottom on corporate tax cuts with, say, the U.S., who obviously is kind of our most, like, obvious economic competitor. That is a endless pit of willingness to cut corporate taxes. You know, so we need to think about what makes Canada, like, an attractive place to invest, what makes Canada an attractive place to start a business. That is a well-functioning healthcare system, which, by the way, in the U.S. is, like, essentially the responsibility of employers. So that takes a pretty big chunk of change off your books. That is a really well-funded, high-quality education system. We have one of the most educated workforces in the world, if not the most, that helps, you know, you find great employees for your business, who are, like, prepared to do the work. That is being, like, an attractive place to live and raise a family and build community, you know, want to start a business. And when entrepreneurs, for example, you know, there's a lot of talk now about, like, we need to encourage entrepreneurship, encourage innovation.
Highlight from a recent episode of the Perspectives podcast. Find out more at perspectivesjournal.ca, at broadbentinstitute.ca, and harbingermedianetwork.com. You can listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. And by the Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archived episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
This is Bird Note. Black-footed albatrosses are masters of the high seas and soar through the air, but their fate is threatened by trouble on land. At their nesting grounds in Midway Atoll in Hawaii, rising sea levels are washing away albatross nests and eggs. But over 3,000 miles away, a surprising rescue operation has been underway since 2021. On Isla Guadalupe in Mexico, Laysan albatrosses were nearly eradicated by feral cats before conservationists intervened in the 1980s. Their successful recovery created a new opportunity, says marine ecologist Julio Hernandez. He is leading an effort to relocate black-footed albatross eggs from Hawaii to the nests of Laysan foster parents in Mexico. But do they notice?
When they hatch, they all look the same, covered in soft gray plumage that helps camouflage chicks.
And when the chicks start showing their true colors?
By then, 4 or 5 months have passed, and there's so much love and care already invested. At that point, they don't care if the chick is black, white, or blue. That's their baby.
Julio says that the Laysan foster parents successfully fledged more than 100 chicks in the first 4 years of the program. After several years at sea, many of the young black-footed albatrosses are already returning to Isla Guadalupe, which may soon be home to 2 albatross species who were given a second chance. For Bird Note, I'm Lucina Melesio.